The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on this week's podcast, we're looking at the fallout from three major news events in the technology space. Research in Motion, the Canadian company that brought the world the BlackBerry, experiences a reshuffle in its upper echelons after falling dramatically from its buoyant position near the top of the mobile race. The film company Kodak announces the end of an era by filing for bankruptcy. And the U.S.'s Stop Online Piracy Act is shelved for the time being, but takes with it a high-profile sacrificial lamb. Joining me to offer insight into the implications of these stories are technology editor Charles Arthur and Observer columnist and professor of the public understanding of technology at University of Cambridge, and I believe John Naughton also at the Open University, amongst other accolades. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
So, John, you've just published a new book. It's called What You Really Need to Know About the Internet, From Gutenberg to Zuckerberg, or rather the other way around, I think. What do I really need to know?
Well, you probably don't need to know any of this because you already know it. But what I discovered, the reason I wrote the book originally was because I was astonished at how many people seem to have misconceptions about the net. And I thought, well, what do people really need to know? And I came to the conclusion they need to know a small number of big ideas. And the question was, how many? And at that point, I remembered George Miller's famous article. He was a psychologist at Harvard at the time, and he published an article with the title The Magical Number 7 Plus or Minus 2. And that was based on the idea on psychological research on short-term memory, and it suggested that people can, on balance, on an average, handle about 7 ideas at any one time, plus or minus 2. So those who are not really up to speed can handle 5, and those who are as sussed out as Guardian podcasters can handle 9. And so I thought, well, let's put in 9.
What's the biggest misconception that you found among people about the internet?
Biggest misconception was people thinking that the web is the net.
Uh-huh.
And I said this to Tim Berners-Lee at a symposium he was running a few months ago, how upset I was to discover that all these people who thought that the web was the net, and he said, it may be even worse than that. And I said, how do you mean? And he said, well, that there are probably 200 million people in the world now who think that Facebook is the net.
Oh, yes. Well, Charles, just off the top of your head, is there anything that you think John might have missed? Lolcats, for example.
No, the thing about books is that you're a hostage to fortune, to the way that time keeps on rolling on. So, you know, I've completed the book for which the last words had to go in December. And, of course, since then, many more things have happened, as we're going to discuss. And things are happening all the time.
Charles, I actually have your book here. This is like a big bookie podcast today, isn't it? It's called Digital Wars, Apple, Google, Microsoft, and the Battle for the Internet. Dare I give away the ending by reading the last words that you wrote it at just before Christmas?
Go on. It's not like a sort of a detective novel. So.
And then they woke up. Exactly. No, the last sentence is, he just needed to find the right battlefield. So, if you're looking for somebody to do the audiobook, Charles, okay. That was my audition. Also in this week's podcast, Charles reports back from his trip to Finland last week. You returned with some rather amusing technologies. I'm currently wearing the anti-seasonal affective disorder ear lights,
yes,
which make me look like I'm in a disco. More later on these in the program, and with so much ahead of us, I hope that you're sitting comfortably. Here we go, 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Hard times have fallen on Research in Motion, the Canadian company that can lay claim to the very first smartphone, the BlackBerry, released years before the Apple iPhone. The beleaguered technology giant has wobbled in its dominance in the business sector, where it's traditionally held court, thanks to some high-profile stumbles, not least of which have been service outages and a tablet-turned-money pit called the Playbook, which we've covered extensively in this program before. Now, rather than go down with their ship, the two CEOs and co-chairmen have decided to jump off the burning platform in the hopes that the next captain will steer this behemoth into more Pacific waters. Charles, what happened?
Well, Jim Balsillie and Mike Lazaridis, who were until Monday the co-CEOs and co-chairmen of RIM, having taken it from the startup that Mike Lazaridis came up with in 1985, I think, Balzilli came along and basically brought a lot of business expertise. They built it up into a multi-billion company, which had at its peak revenues of $5.8 billion, I think. That was a year ago. Since then, the profits have been on the slide, so revenues, and now Torsten Heinz, who's the was the chief operating officer, and to some extent was the guy who was in charge of implementing the playbook, is the new chief executive. They have a chair who's a woman who's come from the board, but she's not really driving things in quite the same way as Heinz is going to be.
So that's a quick downfall. That's 1 year. Why would you say, Charles? I mean, is this because they were trying to keep up with Apple? And what were they doing? What did they do wrong?
I think that actually the seeds of destruction were there a lot earlier, and they didn't recognize it because the smartphone market generally was booming. 2010 was a really big year for smartphones. It saw huge growth, and that was the year when the fourth quarter of 2010 is when smartphones actually finally started outselling PCs per quarter. And I think that RIM was able to ride along with that. But since then, people have been looking to other phones, particularly Android phones. Android is really the reason that the whole phone market has been disrupted in this way, so that companies such as Nokia and particularly RIM have really been hit very hard. Apple sort of seeded the whole disruption with the iPhone back in 2007. Android came along and made it affordable, and RIM really has not had an answer to that.
So, John, who is this new CEO and what's he going to do now?
He may have to preside over a decline. That's a difficult thing for a corporate leader to do, but that's the thing. There are two things about the RIM story that strike me. The first is how quickly things can change, because there was a time when it looked like absolutely stable, very successful, dominant company. And the second, and had a grip, it had a stranglehold on the business market, because once upon a time, the thing that distinguished you if you were a senior executive was that you had a BlackBerry, and that was a sign of real status. There's an irony there because when Britain had its outbreak of recreational looting last year, suddenly the government discovered that actually the spawn of the devil in this case was the BlackBerry. So the BlackBerry went from being a symbol of corporate status to being a symbol of social irresponsibility.
Charles, tell me a little bit more about this new CEO, this decline that John mentions he's going to have to preside over. What do you think he will attempt to do?
Well, the signs aren't very good because the YouTube video that he made, sort of saying, where are we going to go now? Basically, he was saying, yeah, I think that when we're producing products, sometimes we innovate too much, which has got everyone saying, I'm sorry, we haven't actually noticed that. And the message that he seems to be giving is one of, yeah, things are fine. We just need to sort of get a bit more on top of stuff. And actually, that's not the message the market is giving him at all. The stock actually fell yesterday after his pronouncements and after the analyst call. And when the stock is pretty much trading at the value of the sort of bear company anyway, that is, they're not expecting any forward profits, really. For the stock to fall further, when you get rid of the guys who stockholders have been agitating to get rid of, saying you need some sort of leadership, that's a bad sign. Carolina Milanese, who's the smartphone analyst for Gartner, tweeted yesterday that, in her view, this was rather like what Nokia did in the spring of 2010, when things were sort of looking a bit unsettled. You know, Symbian was still then the dominant smartphone platform, but Android was starting to race up the outside, and Apple was really starting to carve things up with the iPhone. And those two, you know, the executives at Nokia could actually see that there was trouble ahead. And so they had a reshuffle, and they put Olli-Pekka Kallasvuo in charge. But that wasn't enough. And eventually, later that year, in September, they ejected him, put Stephen Alp from Microsoft in, who has made a hell of a difference. And I think it's interesting to contrast Nokia and RIM here, because Nokia saw the trouble much sooner, they acted much sooner, and Stephen Alp, I think, diagnosed the problem and sought the solution much more quickly. RIM is saying, no, things are fine. And it's quite possible that they're going to have to do the same and pull in someone from outside. And I was discussing this with Milanese yesterday, and about the only person we could think of was Sanjay Jha, who is presently the head of Motorola Mobility, which is being bought by Google. No one quite knows what will happen to Motorola once it's bought by Google. You know, they say they'll run it separately as a handset business. We'll see.
in both cases, Nokia and RIM, that it occurred to me that perhaps the thing they really missed was the fact that once you gave mobile phone users a real opportunity to access the net, then they would take it. And one of the things that was noticeable about the BlackBerrys from way back was that in terms of accessing the net, they weren't really good. They were really good at email, period.
Does the world need RIM? Well, no. I mean, there have been suggestions that they would perhaps try to license BlackBerry. You know, Hines said he wasn't against it, but I can't see a queue of people lining up for it. Or that it could be sold, but I can't see any companies wanting to buy it. You know, it has some useful corporate customers, but a lot of those are starting to turn away and look to Apple. Apple is actually the big winner at the moment in the enterprise. You know, Android is starting to, you know, get a little foot in the door there, but you know, actually, Apple's making all the running, and I suspect the Nokia will come knocking on those corporate doors as well.
Well, next up in our last podcast, we looked at the U.S.'s controversial Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA, in advance of the congressional hearing scheduled for last Wednesday. After we published the podcast, Wikipedia and other high-profile sites announced a dramatic blackout of their services to protest the proposed bill, drawing attention to what they perceived as its problematic aspects. Now, Congress has decided to shelf SOPA for the time being, at least until a later date, which activists are celebrating as a victory in their corner. However, the same day that this delay was announced, the FBI shut down a leading file-sharing service, MegaUpload.com, and arrested its ringleaders. Now, the other side is, of course, calling a victory for themselves. John, the battle continues. What happened next?
Well, what happens next is that the battle continues. I'm sorry to be so gloomy about it, but that's what happens. The basic problem is that we have accidentally or stumbled into a networking technology which makes perfect copying very easy. It reduces the cost of doing that to almost zero. And we have an intellectual property regime which was framed for an era when copying was difficult, degenerative, and expensive. And in the end, it's not going to work. We can either have the internet and everything it goes with, or we can have what the Hollywood and movie studios and the rest of them want. And so I think this is a structural conflict that's going to go on for a long time.
Why was the architecture set up in such a way? And this refers back to a book that you wrote previously, which was looking at the history of the internet. Why was the network itself set up, or the technology set up in a way that allowed for near-perfect copying? What was the rationale behind that?
Well, perfect copying is an attribute of digital technology. If you're making a digital copy, it's either perfect or it isn't. If you're making analog copies, they do degenerate. But the reason why the net proved so disruptive was because of two things in its architecture. The first was the idea that there's nobody in charge of it, nobody in control, nobody owns it, nobody says who can join or who can't. And the second thing was that it should be a very simple network. It should do only one thing, essentially. It transfer packets of data from one place to another. And it was entirely agnostic about what was in the packet. So the decision was, as somebody once put it, a stupid network with smart applications at the end. So the idea was you had this network that did one thing, and if people were smart enough to do whatever they wanted to do with data packets, then the internet would do it for them, no questions asked. Now, the reasons for that architecture were partly drawn from the bitter lessons of earlier networks, particularly the telephone network, because the telephone network was, first of all, in every part of the world, was tightly controlled. And the second thing was derived also from the experience of the telephone network. The telephone network was optimized for a particular application, which was voice. And what happened when computers arrived is that actually the voice network is totally unsuitable for computer communication. So the lesson from that is, if you design a network that's optimized for a single application, then when somebody thinks of a new application, you're going to have a problem. So the idea was, let's not optimize it for anything.
Let's keep it open and see what people do with it.
And that's what happened.
My question, John, is, I mean, you said that the copyright laws were framed for a time when copying was inaccurate and, you know, degenerative and so on. What do you think the copyright laws would have looked like if we had always had the internet? If, you know, the internet had sort of somehow sprung up, if we'd always had digital copying, would we have any copyright laws?
I think we would. In fact, I think my hunch is that we'd be back to where the framers of the American Constitution were at the beginning, because they thought very hard about this, and they perceived from the beginning that if you want to have innovation, if you want to have creative people doing creative things, then they need to have some way of being rewarded. And their idea was to strike a balance between giving a creative person a temporary monopoly, and then after a time, it's a temporary monopoly, it ends, and then the ideas and the expressions of them become in the public domain, available to society at large. And they said, okay, well, a reasonable kind of balance is 14 years, plus the possibility of another 14. That's a pretty good balance. And all that happened in relation to intellectual property, I think, was that over a period of many years, many decades, because of lobbying from specific interest groups, the term of that monopoly protection, the copyright and other kinds of protection, just kind of gradually extended to a point where it's obscene.
But for example, when it comes to a site like, you know, Mega Upload, which is accused of allowing people to download, you know, the very latest release of, you know, Thor or Mission Impossible or whatever, actually, you reckon that if we had grown up with digital coming out of our fingertips, that actually we'd still want to protect those efforts. It would be the sort of the films that are 14 years old, which would take us back to, I don't know, can't think of a 14-year-old film. But, yeah, those would be the ones where you just, yeah, whatever, go ahead.
There are two aspects to that, Charles. One of them is that you can't implement laws for which there is no general consent.
Mm.
And my feeling is that most people actually think that the idea that creative people should be rewarded is a good and fair idea. There are always people, of course, who don't want to respect property, and there's no question that there are a lot of those on the net and the rest of it. But my hunch is that in the end, successful laws depend on the consent of the governed. And the problem we have, I think, is such a crazy kind of disparity between the legitimate needs of intellectual property holders on the one hand and the regime we've got, that it has fallen into disrepute.
Charles, at this week's DLD conference in Munich, the European Commission's VP, Vice President, proposed a new privacy framework for Europe. And this week it's expected that this right to be forgotten law will be actually proposed in Parliament. Are we in danger of SOPA territory in this part of the world?
I think that the right to be forgotten one is more about personal data, privacy, really there, rather than the idea that, I mean, the thing about SOPA was it was about, you know, stop online piracy. It was about giving content creators in the US the power to go to their attorney general and say, we want this site overseas shut down. So I don't think they're quite going that way. I mean, to some extent, you could say that there's a sort of version of that. Someone pointed out, honest on Twitter, saying, you know, if it was John Gapper in the FT, pointed out that, you know, if you really think that there's no government control of what you read on the internet in the UK, you're completely mistaken already, because, you know, BT CleanFeed is used by pretty much all the ISPs to stop people going and trying pornography. And as he points out, I don't think there's really many people who'd think that's a bad thing.
Well, more on SOPA and, of course, on privacy at guardian.co.uk/technology. Finally, in this week's news, as a camera geek with years spent sniffing developer and stop chemicals in darkrooms, I greatly mourned the end of the film era when last week Eastman Kodak announced that it was filing for bankruptcy protection. The company, which made its name and its fortune as the personal photo revolution emerged during the 20th century, is the latest casualty in the evolution to digital. Ironic, then, that Kodak were also one of the first companies to release a digital camera. And John, you've got your incredibly, incredibly beautiful M9 Leica sitting on the table there that I am coveting. And once I distract you, I will be running out of the studio with that machine. But you said it's ironic that Kodak actually invented the sensor on that incredible piece of technology that you have lying there waiting for me to steal it.
Well, I think it is really ironic, this, because Kodak did invent in 1975 the first, as you said, the first digital camera, and they have actually a very good business in the making of sensors, especially the high end ones like the ones you find in my camera and in others, and they also have a vast patent portfolio in the digital era. So you have this company which in a way was a leader in this technology, and yet has been totally screwed by it. And that's the really fascinating bit about the Kodak story. hindsight is too much of an exact science. I mean, it's easy for us to look at Kodak like we looked at Xerox way back and say, well, this is a company that had the future and fumbled it. Okay, because Xerox, for example, had all the stuff that we use that dominates the computer industry now. In between 70 and 73, they invented most of it. And somebody wrote a famous book about Xerox, which is the title was Fumbling the Future. And I thought of that when the Kodak story unfolded. How could these folks be so stupid? But actually, I'm a bit suspicious of that. If I'd been a Kodak executive in 1976, when somebody came to me and said, look, we've invented this stuff that's going to completely destroy our high-margin business, you'd have said, excuse me?
You'd have said, I'm sorry, my name is Ostrich. And
it's difficult,
that's
though, isn't it? It's the classic thing.
It's the same thing as the music industry, isn't it?
It's a bit like the music industry, and also like RIM. You know, entirely rational decisions at the time turn out in the future to have been, you know, fateful things that actually lead to calamitous downfall.
Well, if they have any old hardware that they want to get rid of, then you can send it to The Guardian and you can put my name attached to it. Tonight I'm going home to listen to my Air Supply LPs and watch Superman on my Super 8 projector. And you can follow these stories and the rest of this week's news at guardian.co.uk/technology. And that actually is true. Last week, Charles was on the final leg of an epic world technology tour. You were in the home of Nokia in Finland. What happened? And can you describe these lights that I've got in my ears?
Well, I saw a number of companies, and I have to correct you, it's not Nokia, even though Stephen Ellop of Nokia might call it that. It is actually, and this is how it works in Finland, the stress goes on the first syllable in whatever. So it's Nokia.
Oh, Nokia.
Now you know.
I do know.
It's not Nokia. It's not Nokia. It's Nokia.
Nokia.
So I went taken by FinFacts, who are the sort of Finnish business development organization, up to Oulu in the sort of middle north of Finland, and also then to Helsinki, which is the capital of Finland, and saw a number of companies there. The lights that you have in your ears will come to in a little moment. Those are made by a company called Valke, and they really do shine LED light into your ears.
They're like earbuds. They're blinding.
It looks like a sort of MP3 player, except it plays light, just a single stream of light. So, in Oulu, it's a sort of a tech city almost. They have a university there which has a lot of expertise in engineering and physics, and has become a sort of base for lots of tech city sort of companies. It's their equivalent of Silicon Roundabout, though it's and possibly about the same size. Aulu's not that giant. In a moment, I'll be speaking to Ari Takkinen, who's the founder and chief technology officer of Codenomicon, about security on home devices such as routers, network attacks, storage, and printers. And also Uusi Schuudelink of Navicron, who designs mobile phones. But I started with Uusi Niisilä of Valke, who's invented this MP3 player that plays light into your ears. And the reason is because he says that it can treat seasonal affective disorder, SAD, which is caused by the long, dark winter months when the sun doesn't, if you're in Finland, for example, rise until 10 in the morning, goes down at 3 in the afternoon. You have long, dark nights. And the lack of light can affect people's mood and make them sort of feel depressive. So I started out by asking him, how is it that it does this?
We are shining bright light directly to the human brain. We are putting the bright LEDs on air canals, and we are shining the light straight to the central areas of the brain.
Why do you think this works to treat SAD?
We have already shown that human brain is photosensitive. We have photoreceptors, opsins, all around the human brain. And we have run several clinical trials to show the treatment efficiency on clinical settings.
And what have those clinical trials showed you?
They have been showing that we get the same or better results on treating SAD than with traditional bright lights or pharmacotherapy.
I think a lot of people would find it incredible that sticking a light in your ear would treat SAD.
Sure they do, yeah.
But I mean, you say that you've got the scientific studies to back this up. Have you had placebo tests against controls to show whether this works or not?
Yeah, we have had, and we have already one result ready. It's done on Finnish hockey players on league level, and we could increase the reaction speed of them in placebo controlled study.
So when they had the light, they had faster reactions?
Yes, they did.
Why have you not been able to do placebo controls with people with SAD?
It's very complicated because they can see that they are not signing, they are active. And you basically should lie to your patients.
And you reckon that you can use this treatment for other disorders as well, for things like PMS and migraine and just sort of shift work and so on?
Basically, the science earlier has found that bright light therapy is effective to numerous mood disorders.
How much does your system cost? It looks like a sort of a bit like an iPod with the headphones. How much does it cost?
It costs 185 euros.
And how long are people meant to use the system for each day?
Each day, only 12 minutes. It's the maximum period.
And you say that you find for yourself, if you start using it too early in the day, you get a bit hyperactive.
It depends. All of us have certain times during the day which are optimal to us. And at least for myself, if I'm using it too early, it makes me hyperactive. And that's something that has been noticed on light research earlier, that we have our personal biorhythms, and we should be able to find our own optimum time to use.
Yusa Nisala, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ari Tuckanen, you're the Chief Technology Officer for Codenomicon here in Aulu. What was it about Aulu that allowed the company to get started?
Basically, there's two factors to our company. One is that it's a high concentration of security researchers, and there's a good environment for security companies here. Lots of research in both university and VTT, and lots of research, lots of grants for security-related research and such, and good support on that. But also, when you start a company, when you are a researcher that wants to become an entrepreneur, there's a good environment, good support for helping in the first steps of the company and setting up, learning the business practices and building your first business plans and getting funding for the first years. So it's kind of like a dream situation, dream place to start up a new company in a high-tech environment.
And you've just done some tests on a number of home systems, home routers, network-attached storage, and other devices, printers, for example. What sort of security implications have you found from those?
We've seen that consumer devices especially don't get enough attention. Maybe the reason is that consumers don't really look at security when they make purchase decisions. They look more at price, and low-cost, low-quality products tend to do better in the consumer market. All consumer electronic devices have a really bad quality when you look at it from security testing perspective. Basically, everything had security problems. Every single device had at least some problems. Low-cost products has had more problems than the high-cost products.
For a lot of people, they might be a bit surprised to realize that their Wi-Fi printer is vulnerable to attack from the internet.
Exactly. Most people don't even notice that. All the equipment that they buy today, they are basically full-blown PCs. There's full operating system, lots of different services, web servers, different kind of software connecting and calling back to the internet, connecting to third-party servers and connecting into YouTube or whatever. So every one of those services is a potential target for hackers as well. So there's lots of different services running on all home equipment.
What's your advice then to the average buyer?
Well, those who have already bought something, update your software. Those who haven't, it might be good to Google your vendor of choice before making that purchase decision.
So I'm with Jussi Schulting of Navicron, which is a company that works on wireless mobile devices. Jussi, just explain to me how it is that a company your size, which is only 30 people, is able to do things like designing an entire phone. How are you able to do that?
We have a cluster of companies here that we work with, so that we have different specialist areas outsourced There's a lot of talent, obviously, with the big Nokia factories and so on. So we have huge amounts of talent here, and we work together with small companies that do specialized items.
So you're, for example, your company is able to design a phone for Acer, which is a big sort of high-value phone company, and you're able to take it from their idea to the actual physical device. How much of that was done in-house, and how much did you farm out around the network?
The in-house parts that we would cover are the software, the hardware design, electrical hardware design, that is, and the production integration. Other than that, we have companies specifically for antenna design and simulation and ID design and so on and so forth.
I mean, one of the things about this area is that everything's pretty much in reach. It's very easy to drive around and reach somewhere. If you were somewhere else altogether, if you imagine that there wasn't the same cluster within easy driving or calling distance, how much more difficult do you think it would make the job of what you're doing?
It would not be possible, or it would be almost impossible. We're located here in the Technopolis because we need to be within walking distance of several of these companies, particularly, for instance, antenna design. That is something that is going back and forwards from us, and so they're only a couple of hundred metres from us.
And you can do that even in the cold winter weather that you get here?
Even in the cold winter weather, even in minus 30.
Because I think people might detect that you're not actually originally from Finland.
Oh, no, I'm from where they call Down Under. I'm an Australian. I came here for my wife dragged me here.
And how do you find the weather difference, the temperature and the sort of climatic difference here?
I actually really don't enjoy the heat, so it's actually lovely for me.
That was Charles speaking with Jussi Schulding, and I feel better already. Can I take these things out of my ears? Now, John Naughton is our guest this week, and as mentioned earlier, he's just released his book, From Gutenberg to Zuckerberg, What You Really Need to Know About the Internet. John, what prompted you to write this? You mentioned before this idea that, you know, people have expectations that are different from realities. But what was there a kind of kernel with it? Was there a moment at a dinner party or in the back of a taxi or in a train platform?
Probably when I was washing up. But what drove it was, years ago I wrote a history of the internet because I was annoyed by the way in which people took it for granted and ignored the people who had built it. And as a result of that, I did a lot of talking, lecturing and teaching about the net over the next kind of decade and a half. And the thing that constantly struck me about this was that somehow we had gone from a period when the internet was weird and exotic into something that it was just like kind of mains water or electricity or something. And I couldn't tell you when the transition happened. When did it become mundane? Okay, that was the first question. But the second thing that struck me was, as I talked to people, and these included government ministers, senior executives in big companies, academics, including some senior academics and so on, I was astonished at the number of what seemed to me to be misconceptions about this network that I found. And it led me to think, how is it that well-informed and knowledgeable people are getting some of this so wrong? Why is it? But, and then I thought, well, okay, it's not their field. Why should they pay much? They do real jobs in other areas. Why should they not? And then I thought, well, what do people really need to know? And that's what led to the idea for the book. It started with, I think the moment was probably a lecture I gave to people from the Cabinet Office, I think it was. And that made me think, okay, maybe I should think about this. And that's where it came from.
It's the hunger in the eyes of the people who just wish it to be made understandable, isn't it?
Well, there's partly that. And it's partly what Manuel Castells calls informed bewilderment. In other words, we know an awful lot of stuff about this, and our newspapers and our media are full of stuff about the net all the time, endlessly, avalanches of books and television programs, and including some wonderful stuff like the stuff you did on the BBC. So they're not short of information about this stuff. The problem, Castell said, is that they don't know what it means, and that's where he came up with this term, informed bewilderment, and I thought it was a great phrase.
So you've got nine areas that you think that people should really focus on. Could you tell me what you think the most important one is?
I think the most important one is the first idea, which was that we need to learn to take the long view about this. Because if it's true, and I believe it is, that we are in the middle of a radical revolutionary transformation in our communications environment, then the thing we have to accept is that we have no idea, absolutely no idea what this means or where it heads, where it's leading. And in thinking about this, I had an obvious idea, which was, in one respect, we're lucky because we have lived through this once before. And the guy responsible for the first experiment was Johannes Gutenberg. Printing did really transform the world. If we're in the same kind of process, then let's, you know, be humble and say. But I had a thought experiment to crystallize this, which I've often used. The first Gutenberg Bibles we know appeared in 1455. Okay, and so I said, let's do a thought experiment. Okay, imagine that you are a Maury pollster in medieval Europe, and you're standing on the bridge in Mainz, which is where Gutenberg lived, in 1473. And you're stopping people. You've got a clip slate, and you're stopping them. And you're saying, do you mind ask you a few questions? And here's question four. Question four is, on a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 means very definitely and 5 means definitely not, do you think that the invention of printing by movable type will, A, undermine the authority of the Catholic Church, B, trigger and fuel a Protestant Reformation, C, enable the rise of modern science, D, create entirely new social classes, E, alter entirely our conception of childhood on a scale of 1 to 5? You only have to ask the question and you realize how absurd it is, because nobody in Mainz in 1473 had the faintest idea that printing would do any of this. And printing did all of those things and a lot more. And why I picked 1473? Well, when I was writing the book, that was we were the same distance into the web, basically. And I thought, okay, well, there's a lesson here, which is we have no idea where this thing's going to play out and how it's going to play out. And I think that's really important.
So is there actually anything that you feel is new about this new technology?
Oh, yes, lots of it. I mean, for example, the way it empowers people, the way it enables what Clay Shirky calls the mass amateurization of publishing, the way in which it enables photographers to put their stuff on the web, people who make movies, and all that kind of the liberation of the creativity of quotes ordinary, unquotes people. I think that's really wonderful, and that's very special, and that couldn't happen before, really. So that's one of the things you can say, okay, the world is never going to be the same again in that respect. But, you know, that's only a part of the story.
And as we mentioned earlier, I think the interesting thing that both you and Charles are struggling with is this idea that, you know, this book is a kind of compendium of the now. It's a snapshot of the now. We're, you know, not only are we dealing with a digital future in which things constantly evolve, but if you want to take the long view, this could potentially be as irrelevant as Google in 5-10 years' time. How do you future-proof a book like this?
The answer is you can't. What you can do is, and you should try and do, I think, is you should say, look, this is how it looks at this moment in time. And you can also say, you also have to be very clear that you're not selling a pup. You're not actually claiming to know what's going to lie ahead, because that's not, I think. And I think if you're upfront about that, one of the things that I really object to about airport books about this stuff is that they're always full of people with a very fake kind of confidence that they know.
Well, from Gutenberg to Zuckerberg, what you really need to know about the internet is available now at Guardian Bookshop. That's it for this week's Tech Weekly podcast. Many thanks to John and to Charles, our studio guests. Next week, we're talking about connected TV. And if you've got any questions you'd like to throw into the mix, particularly if you're an app developer for smart TVs or if you'd like to be one, send them to techweekly@guardian.co.uk. Tweet them to @GuardianTW or post them on our Facebook wall. All the links are on your iPod screens now or on guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Thank you very much to Scott Colley, this week's producer. I'm Alex Kratosky. Until next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.